Okay, so I understand. Lots of kids want to be astronauts. It's like the top three or four things to do, and I get that, but I really wanted to be an astronaut. More than that, I intended to be an astronaut. I found out, in fact, in second grade that most astronauts were pulled from the ranks of Air Force and Navy test pilots. And test pilots don't have very long life expectancies. So I started studying flight, crash, escape scenarios. I read star charts, built telescopes, studied exploration theory, did fitness regimes. I drank Tang. Slept with Heinlein's half spacesuit will travel under my pillow at night to prepare myself for the call. Because these guys were supermen, so I had to become one too. And I tried, Lord knows, I tried. But certain things, the physics, the calculus, the chemistry, they didn't come easy to me. And I don't know when I decided I didn't measure up, but I just felt like it wasn't working. I couldn't be one of those guys. So I started looking for a back door, holes in the system. Maybe they'll need somebody like me someday. I wouldn't say it out loud, but somewhere in the back of my head, I figured it could still happen. The phone could still ring. A couple weeks ago, I went camping on a trail late at night, looked up into the sky, and it was ablaze. And I imagined 7-year-old me, that little kid reading Encyclopedia Britannica about rocket ships with a flashlight, that kid looking up at the grown man I've become. And I wonder if that kid would be pissed. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, Man on a Mission. Amazing stories from real people bound and determined to stick with the plan. My name is Glenn Washington, and if you know someone at NASA, please tell them you have the perfect candidate, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to kick off the show with a story about a man with a very different mission. You see, Dylan Evans was bound and determined to shake things up. And Dylan had big plans.
When the big day arrived, I got up early in the morning. Most of my stuff I'd either sold or given away. All I had left now were a few essential things, a tent, some sleeping bags, some basic cooking equipment, and my cat, Socrates, who was very upset, I think, to be going up to the cold north Scottish Highlands. But I was ecstatic when we arrived, and so I just had to pitch my tent by the river, and that's when things begin to sink in. It's like, right, this is where I'm going to be sleeping for the next year and a half.
Dylan was very, very far from where he'd stood just the year before.
I had, a regular job, and I had a salary, and I had a mortgage and a house.
He'd been working at one of the best robotics labs in the world, tinkering with humanoid robots that could read and express emotions. He had a lovely girlfriend, but something wasn't feeling right.
No, it was a feeling of being trapped, like in a zoo. I was blaming everything on the world around me. And so I think all of these things came together to sort of put me in a position where I felt I just wanted to escape.
Sitting in his lab, where he was surrounded by fly-eating robots and a humanoid head called Eva, which sat propped like a trophy at his desk, Dylan thought, if all this technology that we depend on weren't here for us, could we survive?
If the internet went down and the banking system went down and the shops ran out of food, I would be completely useless.
So he started dreaming of a return to nature, of living off the land, of becoming a survivalist. And that's when he came up with an idea for an experiment. He'd recruit people, and they'd pretend that society had collapsed. Out of this apocalypse, they'd use their own hands to rebuild and create a sort of utopia, a place where humans depend on each other, not on devices or robots.
At first, I called it an experiment in utopia.
This community would be based on three main ideas.
Firstly, it would be a learning community, so each member would have some distinctive skill or area of knowledge that they could teach the others, like growing vegetables or making boots or building accommodation. The second main idea would be that it was a working community, so everyone would have to contribute by working, and the money to fund the experiment would all come from me. The third main idea was that it would be strictly time limited. This was very explicitly just to last 18 months. I phoned up a friend of mine at the time and sort of told her about the idea, and she was saying, well, why do you want to do this? And I was saying, well, you know, I want to, you know, inspire people, I want to make people more aware of the dire straits that the planet is in. And she said to me, Dylan, you've got a God complex. My family, my mother was very worried about what this would mean. My sister would advise me to not sell the house, to take out some legal cover. Everyone was giving me lots of good advice, but I was completely incapable of listening to any advice then. I was just so fired up with this plan.
Dylan sold his 200-year-old cottage in the Cotswolds. He rented 3 acres of farmland up in the Scottish Highlands, and he started recruiting volunteers.
I put up a web page asking for volunteers to come and join me in this experiment in post-apocalyptic living. I didn't really know if anyone would apply at all, but I was pleasantly surprised when, within a couple of months, I already had over 300 applications. So in 2006, I quit my job and I moved up to Scotland to start the Utopia experiment. The first few nights I was there on my own, Socrates, my cat, was really not very thrilled to be living in a tent. I didn't see him very often from then on. The first volunteer to arrive was Adam. He was dressed in a sort of cowboy hat with a feather poking out of his hat band and black leather cycling shorts over sort of bright red socks and a British Airways blanket thrown around his shoulders and a very sort of a long grey beard. He looked a bit like Gandalf out of Lord of the Rings. But he was very passionate about the experiment, and he had been living on various communities around England and Wales for several years, so I thought he was probably quite a good person to have in the sense of being quite experienced about this kind of way of living. The sun was beginning to go down, and Adam and I, we realised that we wouldn't have time to put up the second yurt that day. So we began to make a fire, we cooked some supper, some beans as a stew with some potatoes and carrot, and we sat back and admired the yurt that we'd put up. It was a great moment to look there and look around, and beautiful sight, and listen to the sounds of the birds singing as the sun was setting, and I'd sort of imagined myself gradually transforming from this rather than nerdy robotics engineer into a strapping backwoodsman who could be handy with a saw and a hammer and a screwdriver and a chisel. Adam wandered off to the first yurt to go to bed, and I wandered back to my tent. I sort of snuggled up into my sleeping bag and switched off the torch, and then I thought I heard a wolf howl in the distance. I wasn't sure, but I sat upright and I was strained my ears to listen. And then I heard it again, clearer and louder. There was a distinctive sound of a wolf howling, and now I really was afraid. As I emerged from my tent, the clouds had dissipated and the moon was shedding quite a lot of light, and I could see in this clearing by the trees the silhouette of a man. And from the shape of the hat, I recognised Adam, standing upright by the river, his head tilted backwards as he let out another long, blood-curdling howl. Oh dear, who on earth have I got as my first volunteer? If this is the first volunteer, what are the others going to be like?
One by one, the rest of the volunteers trickled in, until there were 15 of them. There was Nick, a high school graduate, Harmony, a 23-year-old musician with a flute. There was David, an ex-Marine, Angus, an old friend, Romy, she came with a handful of pigs.
There was Agric, who was our expert vegetable grower, Todd, who was good at butchery, Adam, of course, who was always telling us what the Great Spirit would want us to do. It was a lovely group of people, and we were all sort of dressed in thick woolen jumpers and muddy boots and old jeans, and we must have looked like a bunch of rather sort of sorry stragglers. In the distance, you could see snow-capped mountains, some arable land for growing food on. There were no houses visible from the site. It dropped down into this small river valley, which was overgrown with trees, and it did sort of help us to live out this sort of scenario in which we did feel completely cut off from the rest of the world.
In 2 months' time, Dylan and the volunteers erected 2 yurts. They built a shed, planted the first vegetable crops. They spent their days chopping and storing firewood, harvesting food, and making sure there was enough to go around.
We were all very enthusiastic about the way the experiment was developing, and we were very happy. I had fantasies of myself becoming this sort of wise guru-type figure, with all the volunteers looking up to me for guidance, and me sort of providing my wisdom in this sort of paternal, generous, loving way.
But when real tension started to grow among the volunteers, mainly between Adam and the rest of the group, Dylan wasn't sure how to respond.
Adam consistently refused to follow any orders or system that we designed to share out work amongst us equally. That really annoyed people. And then he started squirreling bits of food away that really belonged to the whole community and various tools and hiding them in his yurt. And at one point I overheard people talking about, well, how are they going to administer justice to Adam? One of the volunteers suggested that they should cut his hands off. And the other one said, well, you can't do that. What about the police? And the other one said, well, society's collapsed. There aren't any police around anymore. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing, because I wasn't sure. Did they mean, well, look, maybe society really has collapsed. There really aren't any police out there. But either way, the fact that they were sort of discussing cutting Adam's hands off made me think that, yeah, this crossed that boundary between a sort of imaginative scenario and real life. And at that point, I began to think that, well, this is really drifting out of control here.
Dylan didn't speak up, he didn't ground the conversation or find a reasonable solution to deal with Adam's transgressions. Instead, he just sneaked away.
There's something in me that sort of shies away from that and recoils from ordering people about. I thought that I would become a charismatic leader, but I discovered, much to my own chagrin and surprise, that I don't have it in me for that, and I don't really want to be in that role.
Without a leader, the people of Utopia started to run rampant with the experiment. When Adam started talking about building an ark, like in the Bible, for when the sea levels rose, Dylan became less and less confident that everyone knew this was still just an exercise.
We were still having to buy some of our food because we weren't totally self-sufficient. I was getting very low on funds, and it was only sort of halfway through the experiment. So I confided in Agric, and he said, oh, look, don't worry, Dylan. I think we'll find that you don't need to worry about that, within a couple of weeks or a month at most. It became clear to me that he meant that, in fact, that civilization might really collapse, and then there wouldn't be any supermarkets to go down to buy our food anyway, so money would become irrelevant. When I realized that that's what he meant, I thought, wow, he's even more sure than I am that civilization is going to collapse, not just sort of in the next few years, but, in the next few weeks. And that seemed extreme even to me. And I thought I was sort of fairly convinced and fairly sort of fanatical about this, but these people have overtaken me. 10 months after I'd arrived in Scotland, it was almost like the scales fell off my eyes. I remember waking up one morning and thinking, looking around me at these other people sleeping around me in sleeping bags in the yurt and smelling of wood smoke and damp socks and a bit of rain dripping on me through this hole in the canvas and thinking, what have I done? What on earth have I done? And it's suddenly dawning on me that I had no plan B. I had no plans for what I'd do afterwards. I'd sold everything I had. I'd run out of money. And I was up in the Highlands of Scotland, you know, living in a yurt, surrounded by sort of volunteers who I no longer connected with. The barn where we ate our meals no longer sort of felt like a cozy place to bake a bread and eat supper. It was dark, it was smelly, it was piled high with these plates that we could never get completely clean because we didn't have much hot water. And Socrates, my cat, he found a much warmer farmhouse to sleep in. Occasionally he would come back and sniff around the site and look very disapprovingly at me and then go away again. I began to increasingly just wander off on my own and hide away, find little places, nooks and crannies, or wander down the end of the river or go and walk into another part of the countryside, and just so that I could avoid other people and avoid having to keep up this pretense that I still believed in it when I didn't. I was eating less and I was like a ghost, one of the volunteers later said. I didn't really know what I was doing there anymore. Agric was more convinced than ever that the first signs of global collapse were imminent. Some of the other volunteers were said, you know, why do we just have to go home after 18 months? Can't we just stay here? I mean, civilization's going to collapse soon anyway. And when it did, this would be a pretty good place to be if we wanted to survive. So let's not go. Let's just stay here. Oh my God, you know, I'm going to be trapped here forever. I began to wonder if I could just find some herbal plant that would kill me, or I could just die of hypothermia one evening or something like that. And then I realized, you know, I really did need help. But one day I summoned up my little remaining kind of sense of purpose and managed to hitchhike to the nearest village and see a doctor. When I told him everything, that I was pretending that the end of the world had come and there was a whole community of people living out there and I was the leader, he just thought, this guy is completely crazy. He said, look, this is way above my pay grade. I think you need to talk to a psychiatrist. So I ended up in this hospital being interviewed and having a clinical interview with a psychiatrist. Who again thought, well, this was all delusional on my part. Eventually they did some Googling and found some news stories about it and realised that, in fact, I was actually telling the truth, that I had really, lost my reason in the process of this experiment. I was skinny and malnourished. I was dirty and dishevelled. I was compulsively fidgeting and pulling out hairs on my chin, and it looked quite freaky. The senior doctor said, well, we'd like to offer you a bed here as a voluntary patient. I said, well, look, could I think about it for a while? And they said, yeah, sure. So I went into the canteen and sat there for about 5 hours just trying to make my mind up about what I would do. Would I accept this offer or would I say no and go back to Utopia? I mean, it was clear to the doctor that I couldn't make my mind up. And he said to me, look, we're going to detain you under the Mental Health Act for your own safety.
Dylan spent the next 4 weeks slowly recovering his senses. He was put on a steady diet of antidepressants. He met with his doctor once a week. The nurses checked in on him regularly. He watched a lot of TV, smoked a ton of cigarettes, and he occasionally chatted it up with the other patients.
It was very sort of ironic and in hindsight quite funny, you know. I'd sort of gone off to live in nature with the idea that this would make me happier, and it's actually sort of driven me into the worst depression of my life. Here I was now in a psychiatric hospital, and it was the sanest place I'd been for a year, you know. the other patients on my ward seemed relatively sort of normal in comparison to the volunteers at the experiment. I knew that if I was going to literally, if I was going to survive, you know, I wasn't going to kill myself, if I was had a future of any kind, I had to get out of that awful place that I'd created for myself. When I got back to the experiment, I came out of hospital, went back to Utopia, and I told Agric. I said, look, Agric, it's over. And he said, yes, you mean you're better now? And I said, no, not that. I said, the experiment's over. Oh, you know, I'm sure you feel like that now. You've just come out of hospital. You know, give yourself another week or two. You'll soon be feeling fine and we'll be okay. Don't worry. And I felt sort of, again, the anxiety rising in me. Like, no, you're not understanding. You know, this, I mean it. The experiment is over. It just can't go on anymore. Over the next few days, you know, he and some of the other volunteers came and tried to talk to me and said, you know, you're saying you want to end the experiment, but we're not going. And there's nothing you can do to make us leave. I'd failed to foresee this so completely that I just sort of was bamboozled. I didn't know what to do. I just, for one moment, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be trapped here forever. Or at least as long as they want to carry on the experiment, I'm going to be just sort of sitting in the corner, sort of gibbering away for, you know, the next few months or years on. I'll just be stuck. I mean, I could try and evict them, but it would take months to do that, and I didn't have months because I didn't think I could stay up there for even a few more days without going completely crazy again. It just took me a while to realise that it really wasn't my experiment any longer. It had really become theirs. So one day I managed to get my remaining few things together and early in the morning before anyone was up, pack them up into my beaten up old car, which was just about still working, find my cat who had managed to sort of survive up in Scotland there. And I guess I was really nervous because I just didn't want anyone to see me packing and because they might try to stop me going. So my main concern was just to do it as quietly and as quickly as possible so that I could leave. I began to drive down that road and I looked back, and then at that moment I did suddenly begin to feel this huge weight lifted off my shoulders. I didn't know what the future held. I had virtually no money left, had nothing. But at least I was getting away from Utopia, and that meant that there was hope.
Volunteers at Utopia renamed it the Phoenix Experiment. Some of them are still there. And Dylan, he lives in Guatemala in the company of his wife with 22 horses and 17 Tibetan Mastiffs. To find out more, check out Dylan Evans' book, The Utopia Experiment. Go to the link at snapjudgment.org. The original score for that piece was created by Pat and C.D. Miller, and it was produced by Nancy Lopez. When Snap returns, a man abandons everything he loves in order to save everything that matters. When the Snap Judgment Man on a Mission episode continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Man on a Mission episode. Today, we've got stories from fellas who know exactly what they're supposed to do. Sometimes, you force yourself into a scenario to enact your plan, right? But other times, the scenario comes knocking. Snap Judgment's Anna Sussman spoke with Hamini Jassim.
When American troops marched into Baghdad, a 17-year-old boy named Hamini Jassim opened his front door and saw an American soldier named Brad standing outside.
This probably was the happiest moment of my life. Opening the door and finding somebody out there in front of your door that's just going to change everything. It's going to change your whole entire life.
The American troops told Hamini that they were building a new Iraqi army. And Hamini actually ran to the recruiting station to enlist.
I didn't wait a minute. I wanted to be part of that army really bad. My parents were totally against it. I had a conversation with my dad, and my dad said, you know what? At the end of the day, this is a job that will take your life. He said, you're not going to make it. They're all over the place, and what are you guys are not even 100 soldiers. What are you going to do to fight a whole country? You're not going to make it. And I just told my dad, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Because Hamidi had been waiting for a chance to fight Saddam's government since he was a little boy. His childhood, living under the Ba'athists, was marked by fear and violence.
Being chased by Saddam's Republican Guard, running away from my life, it was just, I didn't have any rights.
He had two uncles executed by Saddam's regime. There was one time when his whole town was accused of plotting against the Ba'athist government.
And all of a sudden, we see the Republican guards coming in with the large empty trucks, trying to put everybody they can to kill them and put them into the mass graves. So many people were killed that day, executed. So many people were actually led to the mass graves alive. Basically, Saddam considers everybody traitor. It doesn't matter if you are one day old, if you are an elder, if you are a child, if you are a young guy, you were considered a traitor by Saddam troops. To be honest with you, I couldn't believe Saddam would go away. You know, I thought Saddam would live for 500 years and we'll never get rid of him.
So even when the Americans came to town, Hamidi doubted that was really the end of Saddam's regime. He had the feeling he was signing up for a very long fight.
Something in my guts told me that these guys are going to come back and they're going to do the same thing again, but this time they're going to be even more furious. And I was number 19 soldier that joined the Iraqi military.
Within a year, Hamidi was promoted to Sergeant Major.
A Sergeant Major usually, it's somebody between the age of 40 to 50 years old.
He was 19.
But it didn't matter because nobody wanted to do it. I was moved to be the Command Sergeant Major for the Ministry of Defense and to be in charge of the security from the inside and the outside of the Iraqi MOD, the Iraqi Ministry of Defense.
The Iraqi Ministry of Defense, or MOD, was an actual physical government building that bordered the Green Zone. Hamidi walked into the MOD to scope it out, and he was, well, stunned by what he saw.
Because I went in there, and all of a sudden I see all these ex-Iraqi military generals.
He saw high-ranking members of Saddam's old military, guys who he says committed crimes against humanity. He saw one general who actually ordered the massacre in his hometown.
And this is somebody I was supposed to salute as a being back as a two-star general. To me, it was just not acceptable. That was the enemy. There was no way this guy was here to build a new Iraq. I found out these guys were showing up to the Green Zone, showing up at the U.S. Embassy, telling them that they want to get their jobs back and they should not fire the old Iraqi army. And you're telling me that I have to protect that building from the inside and the outside while the terrorists are not even outside of the wire. They're actually inside of the building itself.
Hamidi was convinced these military officers from Saddam's old army were positioning themselves to pull off a slow-motion coup.
So if you wanted to really to attack or kill any American advisor who would hold that kind of rank, major into a general, that was the only place in Iraq that you could get hold of these kind of Americans.
Hamidi made sure to stay extra vigilant. He kept his eye on one guy in particular, General Ziad, a former general in Saddam's army who seemed not right.
I end up checking on him, doing a little bit bat in his background, and he ended up living in an area where most terrorists were living. We were wondering, how come every good Iraqi officer was getting assassinated every time they go home? But this guy wasn't. He would go home every single day and nothing would happen to him.
Hamidi told the Americans about Ziad, but they needed real proof against such a high-ranking officer. So without raising any suspicions, he started tracking Ziad. And against the rules, late one night, Hamidi decided to sneak into the general's locker room and break the lock on his locker.
because that was an elite Iraqi officer locker, and I was just breaking the law by opening his locker and going through his belongings. It was either a touchdown or either not. Either I was going to get something, either I was going to be in trouble. I opened the lock, and there was a uniform. And behind the uniform, there was this small black bag. And I looked at the bag. It was kind of dark inside of the locker at the time. I felt there was something in there. I was very nervous. I was about to close the locker. And as soon as I opened the bag, there was a full belt that was full of C4. I realized at the time it was a suicide belt. Definitely the amount of explosive they had in that bag was really powerful. And I had to hit the emergency button to get everybody out of that building. I wasn't sure if that belt would blow up on me.
When he hit the evacuation button, officers and secretaries filed out of the Ministry of Defense. And then he had to walk the suicide belt out of the building and carefully hand it over to an explosives specialist.
Everybody was watching you. And everybody, kind of inside of my head was what was going through at the time is what they were going to say inside of their head. What were they going to be thinking? Now everybody knew this guy works for the Americans.
To a lot of people in the Iraqi Ministry of Defense, the Americans were occupiers.
You're kind of being looked at as the traitor. I felt like a dead man that day, I have to say.
He found out pretty quickly through his contacts that there was an aggressive plan to have him assassinated.
I knew my time was up. I knew that I wasn't going to make it, and something inside of me said, you know what, there's only one thing that's going to hurt me, is how is my mom going to handle it when I get killed? While I'm thinking inside of my head, I'm like, you know what, I'm going to die anyway. At least let me do something good. One morning I was sitting in the office and I got this call on my radio. My soldiers in the front gate of the MOD telling me that there is a woman there needs help and if I can just come out and talk to her. So I came out to talk to the woman. Her son was kidnapped by unknown people and they were gave her a call, told her that they had her son and if she doesn't bring them any money, they wanted at the time around $20,000 cash. And I remember that I lost my own cousin that way. It was really difficult watching that woman being broke and sitting on the ground crying. Can't imagine my own mother being in that position. That woman was trying to kiss my own boots, my military boots, for help. And I didn't know what to do. I was really nervous at that time. I didn't know how I was going to help her.
This was totally outside the purview of Hamidi's job. It was a huge risk.
So at the time, I was dying anyway. I said, you know what? Give me a few moments, I'll be back.
Without alerting their superiors, Hamidi and his team drew up a plan to try and free this woman's captive son.
We were going against every rule at the time because the Iraqi army had no idea what we were doing. All we were doing is taking our military equipment, putting on civilian clothes, going out the wire on our own without anybody permission.
Hamidi and his team found the kidnapper. He says it really wasn't that difficult. They just did a little work tracking down cell phone numbers. They put masks over their faces, silencers on their guns, and busted down the gate of the kidnapper's house.
And we opened the gate, basically, the door to his home. And immediately, they were sleeping all in one room.
They were the kidnapper's family, asleep together on the floor.
We had to put the guns on them. My heart was, you know, I had a quickly heart beating. It was kind of like sad and an enjoyable moment at the same time that to see that, how would they react? How would it happen when it happened to them? It was a really hard decision looking up their face and saying, I do have an innocent person in between my hands. Half of my heart was doing the job that I needed to do, and half of my heart was so much worried about what if something happened.
You can think you're in control, but you can't be 100% in control.
mentally we were, but I thought like emotionally we were not in control. Our emotions at the end of the day were human. I was afraid of something, you know, like when you have the gun in your head, anything can go wrong. Anything. And it was difficult. It was like playing with fire. We're hoping things won't go wrong. I mean, the thing is, we didn't want any child to go through what we went through. Most of my team members were people that was anti-government, who went to prisons as young kids as well, who was tortured. And our only game of playing was to play the same game back at them. If we don't get what we want, their families will get hurt as well. We had to pretend that we are as bad as they are, and we're willing to do anything to get what we want.
Does that make you the same as them?
It doesn't make you the same as them. Inside of us, as a human being, we're not like them. We had a different intention.
Doesn't everybody who's in that position think they're doing it for the right reasons?
Exactly. What we call this is that's the ugly side of war. And inside of us, did we feel bad, guys? Yeah, of course, you're human. You're going to have some guilt. We do know there's some innocence in that circle.
I worry how you were kind of victimized as a kid by those Ba'ath Party members, how eager you were to join the military. It sounds possible. I guess it sounds like you might not know the difference between vengeance and justice.
Justice had to be served at the time. I know that you like that part. It's called terrorist negotiation.
And it worked. The kidnapper buckled. With his own family held at gunpoint, he released the hostage boy.
The mother was kind of like in front of my team trying to thank me and thank my team, saying that I was the terrorist. I was a terrorist whisperer.
Word of Hamidi the terrorist whisperer got around fast. And pretty soon, he says people were lined up at the gates of the Ministry of Defense to plead their case to him. He made more rescue attempts, and some succeeded and some didn't. But the more people Hamidi rescued, the more angry he made his Ba'athist adversaries. He discovered through some intel that one general in particular, a man named General Mezher, was given the job of personally assassinating him.
So Mezher was the guy who was going to make this happen.
Mezher was actually a former naval intelligence officer to Saddam. Mezher had been the local bookshop owner when Hamidi was a kid.
So my neighborhood happened to be with so many ex-Iraqi military officers. So many military officers who was in the Iraqi army lived in that area. So
were you scared of him?
These people are very high up within the Ba'ath Party and very powerful. And they're always in their mad moods, and they're always angry. And I couldn't wait to change that face myself in that office. So my lucky day that Mizher was the guy, the book guy from my town where I grew up, who was selling books to me. But he has only seen me as a child. He has never seen me as an adult. That actually changed the whole entire thing for me, because I know who he was while he doesn't know who I am.
So Hamidi made some phone calls to his hometown, made sure Mezher's family still lived in the same place, put his team in position, and then handed himself over to Mezher, arms up.
I decided to walk to Mezher and hand myself in while my team went out that day. They went inside a Mezher home. They kept his family hostages. At the same time, I walked to Mizer's office and I told him, Mizer, I am here, ready to surrender to you. And Mizer actually stood up, he smiled, and he grabbed me from my elbows. And he said, I'm going to crush your head with my shoes after I kill you. And that was the sentence that came out of his mouth. I said, you know what, before you do that, why don't you give your wife a call? And I mentioned his wife's name as well. He kind of looked like he was about to have a heart attack. Why don't you go ahead, give her a call? And he picked up the phone and he called his wife, and one of my PSD team answered the phone for him. He couldn't stand himself at the time. He couldn't even stand on his feet. He went back, sat on the chair. I looked at him, I said, you know what? I'm going to let your family go. But I know it wasn't going to end that day. I know I had to leave.
Hamidi went back to his office, poured gasoline on his family photos and lit them on fire. He destroyed his computer. Then he actually got on his motorcycle and drove out of the Iraqi Ministry of Defense and over to the Americans in the Green Zone. He continued to work as an intelligence source, but within 6 months, he was shot and almost killed. The Americans sent him to a military hospital and then put him on a flight to evacuate him out of the country.
I was sitting on a window seat. What if something goes wrong in the airplane and the plane has to return back to Baghdad? The pilot made an announcement at the time when we left the borders of Iraq, when we entered the Turkish border. That was the moment when I was really relieved. That was the moment that I kind of felt that I was going to live.
I guess I just wonder if it scares you looking back at what you did.
Oh, of course. And sometimes I look at myself and I just look at myself. I look at the pictures and I say, this was crazy kid who wanted to retaliate back on those terrorists. And when you're young, you're pretty much crazy. You do everything, every crazy thing that's out there. And that's what really made it happen, is that I was young and I was willing to do anything.
Hamidi has written a whole lot about his experiences fighting alongside the Americans. It's in a book called The Terrorist Whisperer. We'll put a link to it on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original sound design you just heard was created by Leon Morimoto, and the story was produced by Anna Sussman. Now, when the snap continues, what happens when a young musician puts everything on the line? In Snap Judgment, the Man on a Mission episode continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Man on a Mission episode from WNYC. My name is Glenn Washington. And today we're exploring stories from people who truly believe they know exactly what to do. And no one knows confidence like Snap producer Davey Kim. His story starts off in a high school cafeteria.
So I'm on my acoustic guitar writing songs for this band I'm in. Me, I've got long hair and yellow highlights, which I straighten 3 times a day, skinny girl jeans, torn up Vans, and I play guitar. Lead guitar. That's when these sophomore girls walk by. They stop in front of me. One of them asks,
"Hey, are you..."
Is she talking to me?
Nah.
Just like that, she walks away. Giggling with her friends, I think I heard her say,
"That guy thinks he's a shredder or something."
Wait, what? That's when I get a text. It says,
"We got the gig."
It's from my drummer. And by gig, he's talking about headlining our first big show at the No Future Cafe. Now, normally, I would be pumped for this show, but two problems. Problem number one, the rhythm guitarist just quit the band, because...
I want to focus on my future, man.
By future, he's talking about his girlfriend and cross country. That's lame, man. Problem number two. The bassist has been pissing me off lately. He keeps on saying,
"Dude, the solo on that new song is... it's way too long."
Honestly, I think he's just jealous, because bassists don't get solos. So I say, "Listen here, I started the band, and I wrote all the songs, right?"
"Yeah, so?"
"So we're gonna do it my way, and my way ends with that solo. And that solo ain't gonna play itself if we don't have a rhythm guitarist backing me up. So chill."
"Alright, man."
After school, I recruit this guy named JJ to teach him the rhythm guitar parts. Now, JJ certainly fits the look. I'll give you that. He's got nice long hair and a pretty face. But...
Okay, so like this?
No. No. Like this.
Okay. Yeah?
JJ can barely manage a basic riff. Every time he tries, he fumbles the pick.
Sorry.
As the leader of the band, I force everyone to stay and practice until midnight. I make sure our hair flips the right way when we squat like crabs and heave our back into it. We do this over and over and over until finally, it's the day of the show. We got the lights, sound check, merch table, and most importantly, our hair looks great. We're on stage and the place looks packed. We've got fans over there. It looks like those sophomore girls are here too. Now we just wait for JJ to tune his guitar for like the fifth time. And with the cue of the drums, we start the show.
Warning, hardcore music ahead.
From the stage, I've seen my friends throwing it down in the mosh pit. Everything is practice perfect. Just last month, I was dreaming of playing up here, and here I am. Our set is coming to an end. It's time for our last song, and the solo. I tap the guitar pedal for a solo boost. Then I climb on top of a stage monitor. I can feel the heat of the spotlight. I'm ready. Then I blink the out. Why is this happening to me? All that time practicing for this? I feel another rush of panic as I scan the crowd at the fans, the friends, the sophomore girls, everyone that I hope to impress. I beg my fingers one last time to move, but they won't listen. Then, from the other side of the stage, I hear a familiar melody. I turn my head and see JJ. He's on both knees, head tilted back, and from his amp wails my solo line. Note for note, and he's crushing it. Quickly, I back him up with the rhythm guitar parts, a part I've never played on stage before. And with that, the set comes to a close. I try to slip off stage, but that's when I hear,
"Hey, you're that guy from the cafeteria. The guitarist, right? That solo. I liked how you and JJ shared it."
I just nod. I'm still in shock. Before I leave, I go to JJ. He's loading his gear in his mom's minivan. I ask him, "How'd you do that?"
"Well, I really liked the solo and I just practiced it by myself. Sorry, it wasn't perfect. It was just..."
"JJ, it's fine, man. You're incredible. And maybe next time, you should take that solo."
"Well, isn't it your solo?"
"Yeah, I guess it is, but it's okay. You can have it."
"What if we split it?"
"Yeah, let's do that."
"Hey, Davey, JJ, the guitar solo? Still too long."
"Nah."
That summer, Davey's high school band dropped an EP which was critically unacclaimed. They toured around their area code, and that solo song was eventually called Long March to Perfection, which it certainly was. Thank you, Davey, for sharing the story, sound design, production, and story of the triple threat himself, Davey Kim. Glenn, I need more stories. I hear you. Listen to what I'm telling you. Subscribe right now to the Snap Judgment podcast. Take Snap wherever you may go. SnapJudgment.org. Snappers, you should know, Snap Judgment Live the show made of fire and magic that you can see nowhere else but on stage, comes to BAM in Brooklyn, to Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Houston, Austin, Dallas, the nation's top storytellers backed by the sexy, soulful funk of Bell's Atlas. I can't wait to see you there. Get tickets at snapjudgment.org. Snap is produced by myself and the team on a mission to rock your world. The Uber producer, Mark Ristich, Pat Massidi-Miller, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Nancy Lopez, Joe Rosenberg, Renzo Gorio, Leon Morimoto, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Matt Ducat, and Jasmine Aguilera. And this is not the news. In fact, you could go straight out of Compton, start a headphones company, sell it to Apple for $1 billion, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.